Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Corbin Weaver.
Dave Etler.
I always like to point out to our listeners that they're listening to the Short Coat Podcast and that I'm Dave Etler. However, my attention-seeking behaviors notwithstanding, I'd like to be sure that our listeners understand that in addition to you, a co-host of Epic Talent, and I, a mere footnote in comparison, we also have Cole Chaney.
Hello.
Aline Sanduk.
Hello.
And Jordan Harbaugh. I mean,
Harbaugh Williams.
Harbaugh Williams.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Dave, that was an intense intro there.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
I want to know, has anything interesting happened to you people? Jordan, you're new on the show.
I am.
Anything interesting happened to you in your first couple of weeks of school? M1.
Wait, yes.
We did the whole M1 show last week, really, but I'm interested to hear if you're... did you listen to the show last week, Jordan?
I don't think I've listened to the most recent one that came out a couple days ago, but...
That's fine. I don't really want people to listen.
I've been exposed. I think I've listened to the last five before that or so.
That's fine. But, I'm really kidding. So the question I asked last week, what's the personality of your class, if you had to give it a personality?
That's pretty hard to categorize such a big group of people. I've been surprised at how broad the personality types are. You clearly have some people that prefer to be on their own and kind of do their own studying and do their own thing and not very outgoing. And then you have people who really feed off the social aspect of school and that environment.
My position was that you all were very social in comparison to previous class. Very outgoing, very...
I definitely noticed a lot of outgoing people.
All right.
I've enjoyed meeting them, so...
The phrase was ski slope nose last week, I think. Remember
I don't know
that?
Who said that.
Can we revisit that?
I remember that person, and she... Don't listen to her. She doesn't know what she's talking about.
Okay. But if she were here, how would she explain that again? Because I think that was an interesting phrase that I've never heard.
Well, we don't want to say her name, so we'll just go with her initials, which are Aline Sanduk.
Whoops.
Oh.
Thank you for the outing.
Explain this again. I just thought it was really interesting. I've never heard it before.
Yeah, so I'm not from the Midwest, but everyone I have met from the Midwest kind of has a certain look. And yeah, so what I was saying last week is that a lot of people in our class are just very pretty, like a lot of pretty men and women. And, you know.
Much like the people on the OSEC staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's, one in particular.
They fit in. It's all, I mean, yeah. It's hard to explain that. Yeah, so what I was saying by that is like conventional good looks.
I found I lived on the East Coast for a while. I was much taller there than I was here.
Really? Yeah.
No, people weren't different. I just actually changed. Like, no, I'm kidding. no, people were generally shorter. And that was something that I think in the Midwest, people sort of, I don't know if it's that Germanic, Norwegian influence.
Corn fed.
Yeah, corn fed deal or what it is. Maybe there's more space, so you spread out, right? You fit your container.
Biological.
Like a goldfish
space
does.
Milling.
I don't know, but that's one thing I did notice.
You know what I've noticed about Midwesterners is they refuse to take up all the available room that they have to them. This plays out in a couple of ways. Like if you're driving, you'll notice that people wait behind you instead of going around you like they could. There's enough room to do that. And we're like, and you know, people, me and my wife, we're from the East Coast. We're like, go around. Why are you back there? Or if you're like at the coffee counter. And there's plenty of room for a second person to take their coffee and put their creamer and sugar in. They won't. They'll just wait for you to move out of the way.
That's a good point.
We're
patient
people. You know what they
call that?
They're polite. That's what they're...
Yeah. We are
patient
people.
That doesn't exist. The politeness doesn't exist on the East Coast.
They're patient. They're patient, and they don't mind waiting an extra minute for you to get your life together.
If we're polite on the East Coast, it's because we feel some sort of obligation to, but inside we're like, I hate you.
So does the Midwesterner explode at a certain point? All this repressed?
No,
the
anger just swells inside them until they die.
And then
I don't know if there's so much anger. It's just they don't get angry. They just get very disappointed.
Oh, Dad, that was
that makes sense. Yes,
that's true.
And you might know that they're disappointed, but you might not. Right?
Yeah. Either way.
Yeah.
They don't let it show.
It's a trap.
All right, Akbar.
What about you guys? Any interesting events this week that you want to...
So today is the deeded body ceremony, which I always think is a cool thing to talk about and acknowledge. Mm-hmm. So this is the cadavers donated you know, usually it's the cadaver. Sometimes it's the family. Sometimes it was the person who became the cadaver. Sometimes it's actually a person who maybe does not have a family to claim them. And so through state processes, they actually become part of the cadaver program here at the university. And these people, you know, so in addition to what happens, you know, the students are very respectful. Their bodies are used for science, for almost all of the medical and health sciences programs here. But there's also this big ceremony at church where a lot of med, dent, nursing, speech path students come and they eulogize, they speak, some perform songs, some play instruments. And it's a really cool ceremony. I think most of the med school goes, most of the other health science go. Families are there, people talk, and it's a really cool program.
When is that?
This afternoon, 2 o'clock.
Well, it's too bad that this show isn't live, because information has no relevance to our listeners in 4 days. But
now they can look back on it with perspective comes out.
That's part of the process, actually.
Yeah, it is reflective. The idea is to be very reflective about it, to you know, sort of think about this contribution that has been made by these folks.
Well, and the thought too, I think families. You always hear sort of about the horror stories of the old anatomy programs where maybe you give your donor a name and there's sort of a more jovial approach to this cadaver lab, and that's totally gone now. You know, it's very much the person it's your patient. And so you actually, at least in our lab, when you speak of them, you speak to them, you know, the patient suffered this, the patient has this. And so you're trying to change the narrative on it. Because you could be really, I don't know, if you were going to donate your body, I think you'd really want to be treated with the utmost respect.
Yeah, and there have been cases in the news I've seen over the years of people not being as respectful as they should, even to the extent of like taking selfies or things like that. And that's pretty low, and it's a real problem. Well, then, Dietedbot, thank you for bringing that up.
Yep. Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed. I actually have anatomy lab during the deeted body ceremony.
I know,
that's
right?
Where they scheduled that.
It's unfortunate. I talked to Pizzamenti about it. He basically said it's mainly for the families.
Okay.
And also, the bodies that we're dissecting will be in the deeded body ceremony next year.
Sure.
So we get to go to that one. It won't coincide. But unfortunately, half of the M1 class will be in the lab today.
Yeah.
Sorry
but
about that.
Yeah, it is.
Why weren't we consulted about this? Obviously, we're the most important individuals.
Clearly, you haven't gotten to the point yet in the curriculum where you actually do feel like you're the most that you should have indeed consulted.
Nope. There's this awesome phenomenon right now where they're changing the curriculum here at the university, and much of what I would call my coursework looks nothing like what the M1s have as their coursework. And so there's this awesome thing where people ask me a question and I'll go, well, you know, I like to do this approach to studying, although I'm pretty sure that doesn't apply to you at all now. So every piece of advice is essentially worthless now, coming from older people.
I wouldn't say worthless.
It's worthless, not worthless.
Oh, pardon me. That puts
a different spin on it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, at one point, retaining information is retaining information, sure. So...
Well, the goal is to, like any other learning process, you take in the information, you do something with it, decide its importance.
Integrate it.
I was shaking my head. I was like jumbling the info.
Mixing it. I thought you were like making fun of my head movement.
No.
You take that in, you put it into some sort of perspective, you mess with it, you fiddle around with it, and hopefully you get something. Even the people who are terrible. You know, perhaps that person's role is to teach you how not to do things.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Everyone's a teacher.
That's right. What else? Anything else interesting happening in the world of medical?
I have some special news.
Yeah, go ahead.
Corbin shared with me this week that she's going to run for a position on student government.
All right.
M1
official
representative. And I have self-appointed myself campaign manager.
PR
so if you're
team
out there listening, I just want to share a little bit about Corbin's experience in student government. She was appointed representative of the year her senior year at Creighton and helped write the new bylaws for the student government. So I think she's almost too experienced, overqualified for this position. So
did you go to school together?
No, we met the last year.
Did you like do some internet research on her? Did you type in Corbin? Are you stalking Facebook?
You know a lot.
This is how I ended up here. I knew Corbin did it, and with the most respect meant in this, I said, if Corbin can do it, I can come on here.
Yes.
That said, I have the utmost admiration for Corbin, and I am glad to work hard on her campaign. Wow. Which I'm starting now. It's, I just made it official though. So
wait, what is the position you have? What is the position you're most? I imagine you're sort of weighing your options, like people do. Them. You know, you're weighing a run, as they say.
Yeah. I was gonna do a little straw poll, but I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah.
No, I was thinking about running for the M1 representative
to
the Carver College Student Government.
Oh, okay, all right. Because there's committees too.
Yeah, there's committees, and there's also a education related one that seems interesting.
Right. Right. Well, it could be the sort of job that nobody wants, and maybe you would just win.
Hey, you know, that's what I'm banking on. That's the type of position I'm exactly qualified for.
Your enthusiasm is overwhelming.
What does the M1 representative to student government do?
Well, it appears they go to meetings, and I have the exact description. They're also a representative on the...
This is not an open book quiz, Corbin Weaver.
The graduate student government.
I'm just kidding.
And they're also like a liaison for the interests of the M1 class, I believe.
I have no doubts that Corbin Weaver could do an excellent job. I can't not say your whole name, by the way, I've discovered.
It's solid. Right.
It flows off the tongue.
Is this the first time you've heard that?
No, you know, a lot of people just kind of go with Corbin Weaver, which is fine. Or they like to shorten Corbin to Corbs or Cor.
Corby.
I prefer Corbs.
Corby. Corby's not my favorite, but... I'm not going to tell you. You can't say it.
Then that will be the one I use.
Now that I'm thoroughly uncomfortable.
Whoops.
You outed her as a candidate.
I did.
You're.
I guess now I have to send that email to the person running this election.
She makes no warranties, express or implied. For goodness sake.
I did not officially endorse this message.
That's
so.
Right. We'll be back in just a second on the Shortcut Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Guys, there's been a setback in Texas for thinking outside the box in medicine.
You're so dramatic today, Dave. All right, let's hear it.
It's the coffee with the extra shot of caffeine in it that you brought me.
Well, the backstory is I like to bring Dave coffee once in a while, and he said, "Well, I didn't want it today." And I said, "Dave, no one else will drink coffee with a shot of espresso in it. That's disgusting. So you have to have it."
Yes.
All right.
My heart is pounding.
What's in Texas, Dave?
Dr. Courtney Ricardo Morgan, 43. He just wanted to help people.
Courtney is a guy's name?
Yeah.
It is now.
He's a dude. That's all. He just wanted to help people. So he opened a drive-through pain clinic in Victoria, Texas. The fact that it wasn't a licensed pain management clinic, according to the Texas Occupations Code, which allows docs to prescribe pain medications to more than half of their patients, well, surely that was an oversight. The majority of his patients did in fact receive pain meds. He told investigative reporters of the Victoria, Texas Advocate, the Victoria Advocate, that he didn't prescribe narcotics, although the indictment claims he did issue prescriptions for opioids, benzodiazepines, barbiturates, and carisoprodol.
Sounds good.
I think at least one of those sounds like a
believable
narcotic.
Yeah.
Yeah. A video from the report showed Victoria Advocate showed a reporter receiving a drive-through prescription for medication after speaking with Morgan only over the phone, which was, according to the DA, a peculiar way to prescribe medication.
So you call him, you say, "I have lower back pain," then all you have to do is drive up and they will hand you the prescription. Getting this right?
That seems to be what the article said. I just think, you know, he's just trying to think outside the box.
He's a businessman.
Medicine has become a business.
That was a conceptually adventurous attempt to think outside the box.
He actually had two locations, both of which are not operating anymore.
This isn't that crazy, though, with the medicinal marijuana dispensaries. I've heard it's very comparable. I think you can call in. So I feel narcotics are another level, perhaps. But in his mind, he saw maybe this model.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting that you bring that up, because I the connection between medical marijuana and narcotics has come up. In our Twitter feed this past week, I noted a study that said states in which medical marijuana legally exists have lower overdose rates by pain pills. So,
Wow.
Interesting, interesting.
I don't think that's, I suspect that's not what Dr. Courtney Ricardo Morgan was banking on.
No.
What wasn't it for him, though?
I think the operative word is bank.
Yeah.
Money.
You may be right.
All right, I got stories. This has turned into like addiction pod. I feel like all we do is talk about like interesting drug things.
All right.
So mine is too.
We have a niche that we need to fill.
It's interesting. I think that's one thing. Like, you know, I think Orange is the New Black's popular because prison's interesting, and also like drugs are interesting.
They're chic right now.
They're chic. Yeah, it's very hot. App distinguishes fake tremors from real tremors in withdrawal patients. Okay, so people who have this severe alcohol addiction, when they withdraw, there's a period of these bad shakes they get. You know, delirium tremens, they're hallucinating, but also the shakes are really bad. And so what doctors will do is prescribe benzodiazepines, an equally addictive and sedative drug, to these patients to help them come down, because these are actually can be very dangerous. These shakes. Problem is, some people will fake these shakes to get the benzodiazepines. And so what they did is they designed this app that actually could figure out the frequency of shaking in one's hand, which is where you get the really bad extremity shaking. And then it could track the frequency, and then they tested it, okay? And so what they did is they got a bunch of nurses who work with these patients every single day and said, I want you to do your best imitation of what you see.
Oh man, that's great.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So then what they did is the nurse had them shake, and only 10% of the nurses were able to get a positive diagnosis on the app.
So if they can't,
if they can't fake it, then there's no way some guy who's never even seen the shakes, or maybe has read about it on Wikipedia,
or even who has experienced them, because let's face it, their experience might be somewhat different.
Exactly. So I thought it was a really cool way to use technology, the iPhone. I think a lot of people are very, you know, us as healthcare professionals, sometimes we want to take your blood pressure. We don't want some stupid app to take your blood pressure, but it's a really cool way to incorporate that into it.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of cool ways to incorporate technology.
Yeah.
Into medicine. I know I saw something where you have the pill calf that alerts you when to take your meds, flashes, and texts you. So
yeah, I have a home automation system in my house that I'm sort of slowly building up as I have like money. yes, it costs a little scratch.
Ching.
One of the use cases for it is to, you know, sort of put a sensor on your medicine on your older maybe family member's medicine cabinet, so that you can tell whether or not they've opened the medicine from a distance. You can tell whether or not they've opened the medicine cabinet that day, and hopefully have taken their medications. I mean, it's just one of many.
So, is your house? Are you on the thing Nest? I think that's the app where your temperature goes up and down.
No, I can't afford them. That's okay. Like a $250 thermostat. That's not.
So, what are you automating then?
Smart Things is the application. It's a hub, consists of a hub and then some various devices throughout the house that create a mesh network. So light switches and motion sensors and contact sensors and all that kind of stuff, so you can trick out your house. Unfortunately, the individual bits you know, cost like $50 a piece, so it's not something that I could just go out and throw money at. I have to sort of.
I still understand what it does for you.
So for instance, I do have another sort of thermostat. So instead of setting a timer, which may or may not be right, it turns on when I come home.
Oh.
Turns off when I leave.
Does it also greet you? Say,
it
hello,
could.
Dave.
It could. In fact, it's compatible with the Sonos system, so you could, you know, plug it into that, and it will sort of, you know, when you wake up and it senses motion, it will read you the weather news and say, "Good morning, David." Turn on your coffee maker, that sort of thing.
I don't think
I'm going to go that far with it. I don't think I can afford that.
I've read a couple articles about this, and it's always about the guy who's just gone nuts with it, right? And tricked out his entire house.
Yeah, I've got 60 things,
you know, get every single piece of technology possible, and it's just turns out to be a conversation between him. He's talking to his machines.
This kind of reminds me of the Disney Channel original movie, Smart House. Anyone?
Yep.
Yeah.
So this family enters a contest. They win a smart house. Everything's completely automated. And then the house turns against them.
That's
I would say be careful,
day.
Dave. That's of my research. Careful with how far this goes.
It's a good point, because every once in a while, something doesn't work properly, as you might expect it. Like, I'm sitting in my chair reading, and the lights go off, and I'm like, What the hell?
That's actually not where my brain went. My brain went to a Terminator-like future where I'm like, yes, keep saying nice things so when they all become self-aware, they'll kill us less.
I'm just saying that the lights going off by themselves, that's an indication that my house is messing with me. I also have sensors which detect leaks and then shut off my whole house.
Cool.
Water valve.
That's
I have had three water events.
That's paid for itself.
My insurance company fired me. I'm like, I'm done with water in my house.
Wow.
So solid.
All right. You want to talk about this secret drone issue?
Yeah.
I brought secret drones. I was going to talk about COPD, but it looked boring. So we're going to talk about drones instead. Google unveils that they've been doing it. So the FAA is really strict on drones. So they regulate all the airspace in the United States. So Google said, fine, we'll go to Australia. So they just unveiled today that for the last 2 years, they've been testing self-flying drones for package delivery. Announced Friday.
This is Google.
This is Google. Because
Amazon wanted to do this in the
US. This is their response Amazon. Okay. So they're working on getting the appropriate regulations and get all the paperwork in. So they say it's only a couple years out now. And so the FAA has restricted commercial drone testing in the meantime until a 2015 deadline when they will start to perhaps allow direct delivery. Although Google doesn't do a lot of commerce by my... Right? Or maybe this would be part
maybe
of the...
Maybe this is a play. They're getting into a whole bunch of
they're
things.
They're everywhere.
If they can, you know.
And so I think this always makes people... Everyone sort of the big brother deal, and do you want drones flying around? So
I think it would be very odd to have a package... To have a tiny helicopter deliver a package to your doorstep. Like, that would just be weird.
Awesome.
And what would prevent me from saying, oh, nice package. Make drone. I'll take the drone.
That's how's any cool. different than today, though?
I guess. So. Well, it's hard, a little. I guess you could steal the delivery truck.
There'll be machine guns on the droids.
You probably couldn't control it either.
What applications for medicine could drones have? That's what. Let's brainstorm.
So here's my favorite one, I think, was Star Wars. I remember that Princess Leia wouldn't give up the secret plans, and Darth Vader's like, we'll get you to talk. And then this little orb drone comes in with all these needles and torture tools on it. So I think that comes to everyone's mind first, probably.
I think it might be cheaper just to have an unethical person like walk into the room.
An unethical robot. That's an interesting point.
I don't know. Like, why does it have to be a floating? Plus, if it was floating, I feel like it would be easy to just push it away.
Because it's George Lucas, that's why.
All right. Fair enough. So he goes right towards torture.
Yeah. Sports, I think, are an interesting application.
Delivery of medicine to the elderly.
Delivery of medicine to the elderly.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of how my grandmother, who's passed on, but I'm trying to think of how my grandmother, when she was alive, would react to a drone appearing on her doorstep with her medications.
I can see my grandparents like talking to it.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can definitely see it producing some anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. I think some buzzing thing. And they probably don't really sound all that like comforting when they.
No. I know my brother camped out in California in this desert where they're testing drones and they didn't know beforehand. And apparently there's all these creepy colored lights like purple and green.
Oh, sweet.
And yeah, I kind of freaked them out. But that would freak me out a little bit if I just went outside and there were these colored lights
drones. And we're
in the
not
sky.
80 years old.
It's like, oh, that's my medication.
So they're also doing, I know crop dusting now some drones can do. Although some old school farmers aren't down. And then the other interesting application is that on large cattle herds, they're able to actually identify via somehow like radio waves or something. They can identify the body temperature, which these cows have significantly different body temperature if they're unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so it can actually tag them.
I could see how that would be useful.
And then the people come in, these massive 3,000 herd or cow herds. So there's pretty cool.
So if you apply that to medicine, you could have like drones floating over a city and detecting when people are sick and being like, you get to the doctor.
Go get out.
I'm full of good ideas.
Yep.
I gotta tell you, this coffee is just hitting the. It's hitting several spots.
Okay.
All right.
You're actually like today. You seem as verbose. Your words are very flowing and eloquent today.
Tulane School of Medicine. It's opened a first of its kind teaching kitchen.
Ooh.
Its goal is to teach doctors and medical students how to cook, so that they can pass on delicious advice to their patients. The kitchen is part of the Gold Ring Center for Culinary Medicine.
Okay.
What does Hippocrates say? I see this quote in our hallway all the time. Mm-hmm. Make food your medicine and medicine your food or something. It's been in operation for a couple of years now, serving a slow trickle of students. But now this kitchen means that 190 students every semester can enroll. Teaches diet, nutrition, preventative medicine, I'm not sure about that last part, but I guess if you're eating right, prevent disease.
Mm-hmm.
The Institute of Medicine recommends 25 hours of nutrition instruction, but only 27% of schools actually reach that goal. So they're trying to fix that a little bit.
That's a great idea.
Would you go to? Mm-hmm. I might go to a cooking class.
That would help me personally,
right?
Not just your mm-hmm. patients.
Well, I think that's the idea. If we help you as a medical student or a doctor, then you can turn that around and sort of help your patient.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea for sure. But you know, something that I worry about with things like this is if you're dealing with patients who can't afford to eat healthy because they live in a place where they can't go to a grocery store or they can't, you know, all of the foods that are bad for you are the ones that are subsidized.
And so they're easy to get. Yeah.
And they're easy to get, and they can't afford the food, you know, that you need to put into this healthy meal. It's not going to help your education at all.
Interestingly, I thought of that when I was reading the article. There's a Whole Foods located right next door.
How convenient.
Yeah. I think you're being a little sarcastic there. I mean, it makes sense that you're being sarcastic because Whole Foods is an expensive place to shop. On the plus side, they don't use things like tofu or seitan or things that their patients might be a little reluctant to, or they're, you know, they might be a little, people might be a little reluctant to try. Instead, they use ingredients that are commonly available that they, you know, quote, everywhere to make it easy for them and their patients. All they do.
I mean, the thing to comply.
They're not doing like, you know, weird vegan
tartare.
Yeah, stuff. They're doing like,
everyday normal.
Yeah. I mean, Harvard just came out with a study too, the sociological study that said this sort of concept of food deserts, while not false, is maybe a bit ill-informed. They found that some of the, you know, there are the McDonald's, but there's also, they found that most urban areas actually have access to, so they classified the healthiest meal as being sack of beans, sack of rice, apple, mm-hmm. milk. And actually, most places that we consider food deserts did actually have access to these things. Now, preparation is always the one issue I think a lot of people throw out there. And that's maybe more of a education as opposed to a financial issue. You know, you need to be educated on how to maybe prepare a meal in advance, store it in advance.
Yeah, I got to say, the convenience factor of pre-prepared foods is really hard to beat.
That's mm-hmm. hard, right? Mm-hmm. And that's purely, I mean, it's as easy as buying cigarettes, right?
As a parent, I can tell you that sometimes it's really hard to say, no, I'm not going to throw these chicken nuggets. I can say it's impossible. I'm going to be honest with you. I was going to sugarcoat it.
Okay, let's hear it.
But here's the thing. I do not have time, or at least I feel like I do not have time to make a meal every night for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And you have one job. Some of these people have two or three.
So exactly.
It's an interesting point.
So, mm-hmm. Okay, so way to call me lazy. Sack. Thank you.
You're among friends, but Dave. We're not judging you.
Yes. Nobody else can hear that.
I think Corbin has a good point, though. I lived in New Orleans for 4 years. I went to college there, and the Whole Foods is in a pretty wealthy neighborhood. It's not in the areas of the cities which have food deserts and where there's only Walgreens available.
Yeah, true. I mean, if you go to Walgreens, you're not going to...
It's hard,
right?
I think a lot of patients we're going to see are not going to be, in the position to be able to implement some... They're just, like, on the brink of survival.
Yeah.
Basically.
But before we tear it down, though, it is cool to think that the person who maybe has hypertension, high blood sugar, I realize, you know, this whole issue, our food desert issue aside, it is cool that you could say maybe, hey, you know, we can talk Lipitor, we can talk insulin, but let's also talk maybe about food prep. Like, that's I think it's a really cool angle to take.
And the center also has a free 6-week class for community members, so it's not just, just serve the medical community. So, kind of cool. I'm noticing that there is sugar in the bottom of this coffee.
Did you not want that?
That's fantastic.
Oh.
It's like an extra, an extra little joy.
We're going to have a show called Dave Does Coffee. Just he sits there and tastes it.
Discusses his coffee.
I'm just on coffee, I promise.
Yeah.
Let's see.
You want anybody else? Story? Did you bring anything?
I have an article today.
I did.
Oh, all right.
All teenagers across America can rejoice because the American Association of Pediatrics, I think that's what it's called,
mm-hmm.
Issued a policy statement that school should not start before 8:30 for the health of teenagers.
Yes. I think this has been talked about for a while, but this is the first time... Or maybe the first time that they've sort of come out and said, you guys are doing it wrong.
Yeah, and I thought I didn't really realize the exact science beforehand because they're saying, actually teenagers need 8.5 to 10 hours of sleep. And, you know, you think, well, why can't they just go to bed earlier? But apparently when a person reach adolescence, their sleep cycles get pushed back 2 hours, so it's pretty much impossible for them to fall asleep before 10 or 11.
Yeah, I think it's, I think any, I'm not a parent of a teenager, but I know parents of teenagers, and I was a teenager once, and I can tell you that it's not quite about, you know, what you want to do or need to do. It's what body just makes you do.
So, and, is it based on the light? Is that why?
It didn't go into that much detail about it, but
I think teen metabolisms just need more rest.
You're screwed up as a teenager.
Yeah.
Your whole body's different.
I just know myself, and I think I love this recommendation. I was thinking about myself. I'd probably stay up later in high school. That's why I'd be like, oh, 8 o'clock, great. I can stay up till 2 instead of midnight now. But maybe that's wrong, because these are smart people who...
Well, there's always the law of unintended consequences, so you could change things, quote, for the better and have it not work out the way you wanted to. But it would be interesting to see, you know, it would be interesting to be able to try that. It would be interesting to see how, you know, if a school system, the problem with schools, the problem with the public school system in general, not that it's a terrible thing, but the problem with the public school system in general is that it's based on, you know, sort of the Industrial Revolution ideas of education. So, you know, it's very much sort of an assembly line situation. You know, it's a lot like, in a way, it's a lot like medicine, you know, like being in a hospital. You know, things are done for the convenience of the school system and the teachers and the administrators and all that kind of stuff, as well as for the children. So, you know, whether or not an individual school system can say, you know, yeah, we'll do this, probably there's probably more to it than you know, to logistically.
School boards have already come out really strongly against this. That's been in the news pretty bigly.
Bigly.
That's a word now. Which I thought was sort of interesting, and also looks, I mean, which side do you want to fall on when you look back? Like, we're the school board that hates change and progress, and
nobody likes change.
No. Hates data. Yeah, that's data.
Hate science.
This week, folks, this is exciting. 38-year-old skeleton removed from 62-year-old woman.
Oh, it was teratoma?
Whoa.
Stone baby.
Oh, man.
They
have, like, teeth and everything. Hair.
Lithopedion. You know, this headline threw me for a loop, because the headline made me think that this was a 62-year-old Indian woman whose skeleton was only 38 years old.
That would be interesting.
That would be very interesting. And so I immediately looked at it.
So she was like an amoeba up until she was like 28?
Yeah, until she... Turns out that's not true, Dave. Gosh, what an idiot. She had an ectopic pregnancy when she was 24.
Okay.
She was scared of the surgery to remove it, so she left AMA. And her pain was, and had her pain treated at a small clinic.
Wow.
The pain abated for decades and finally returned. Docs thought it was cancer. A CT scan showed...
It kind of is cancer.
Yeah.
Like, in a weird way.
CT scan showed a calcified lump.
Oh.
Which turned out to be, quote, and this is a doctor saying this, so I was, again, I had to do more research, which I hate.
Yeah, that's not fair.
Of course, it turned out to, the doctor said it turned out to be, quote, a child's skeleton.
Wow.
Which brought up a whole new set of problems for me intellectually, like, was this child growing inside her and become a child? I mean, it wasn't a fetus. That's my point. He didn't say a fetal skeleton. He said
it was child.
A child's.
But it's also been there for how many years? It should be an adult by then, right?
Yes. Well, that's why, I mean, it brought up a whole series of questions, but no, he meant fetal skeleton.
You always get those crazy stories over in some of these more impoverished third world areas. The kids with the teeth, like the shark teeth they pull out, you know, they pull out 72 teeth.
But I did learn a new word, lithopedion.
That's the name of the disease?
Yeah, stone baby.
Lithopedion. Huh. Oh, that actually makes perfect sense. Yep.
It was a little hard to tell, because they said this woman held the record for the longest ectopic pregnancy, which I don't know if you can call that the whole period an ectopic pregnancy. But previously, there's also been a Brazilian woman who waited 44 years to have the unions removed. So
it's always incredible, these people that have, you know, the elephantitis. Some of these guys get these massively swollen testicles. It's always these stories.
Once again, he has to bring up the massive.
I think I've been there like 3 or 4 times in this podcast. But it's always like, how do you get to that point?
We all have themes in our lives. It's best that you embrace your
repressed
giant testicular theme.
I like basketball a lot, I think. I always think it's interesting how you get to that point. I think most of these people can't afford it. But even there's some people in America. And how do you get, you know, I understand maybe you start out at a certain disease level, but how do you get it to this huge, you know, you never take care of it.
Yeah,
this one I think sounds more financial. I mean, it sounds like,
she just thought it went away.
Yeah, didn't feel any pain.
Yeah. You guys know I like 3D printing and all things
that's cool.
Biomedical.
Yep.
Chinese doctors have just used a 3D printing to replace half of a man's skull. The surgeons used a 3D printed matrix of titanium to rebuild the skull of a man who was injured in a construction accident. He fell three stories onto his head and lived, obviously some brain damage, but the left side of his skull was crushed. The custom titanium mesh was printed in three dimensions. Not a cheap process. I don't think it's sort of ready for...
the titanium skull?
Yeah. It was sort of like... So if you imagine, if you sort of bisect your the front view of your head into four quadrants, okay. It was sort of the top left quadrant was just missing of the skull. So they had to sort of print that section of his skull. Mm-hmm. In titanium. Stryker, the international medical tech and implant firm, sponsored that portion of it, and the hospital covered the rest of the cost. Surgery only lasted 3.5 hours. I'd have thought it'd been longer.
That seems like a long-term surgery.
That seems like a long surgery?
That seems like it would be...
I'm saying
it would be like 20 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Blood transfusions.
So, kind of interesting. Surgeons hope that... Now, this puzzles me. Surgeons hope that once his skull cavity is restored, his brain tissue will regenerate and he'll regain the ability to speak and write.
Whoa.
Does that sound likely?
No.
I'm not sure that this...
Your brain rewires, though. Maybe
there's plasticity and all, right?
Neuroplasticity. Have you seen these new apps that you... what is it? There's this, like, neuroosity.
Lumosity.
Where you go and you basically play, like, Super Mario and somehow you get smarter.
We're going to find that that's crap.
They're like, and it's approved by neuroscientists. That's always their claim.
Yes, Dr. Oz, the neuroscientist.
Seems a little bit opportunistic.
We'll just go back to that.
Yeah, but that actually reminded me of these 3D printers. I once talked to an ophthalmologist, and he picked up one of these things for $200-$300. And he was talking about, he was excited about it because he could try and design his own little tools, because he does cataract surgery and other surgeries, and he was thinking, oh, I could maybe develop a tool that's more useful for me and just go into the program and kind of develop his own little prototype and experiment with it. So that struck me as kind of cool, the really lowering the barriers to innovation in medicine.
Yeah, I want to point out that as of soon... there will be an MIT style fab lab opening in Iowa City in the Sycamore Mall.
Wow!
Where you can do things like 3D print and have computer controlled milling and all that kind of fancy stuff, as well as regular stuff like carpentry and auto mechanics, and sort of you purchase a membership and you can go in and make whatever you want. In fact, I'm a volunteer in helping them set this up. And I've been thinking lately that medical students really need to sort of get on this, because I bet that it's going to become a more important part of medicine, 3D printing in particular, in medicine. As it's already become a part of medicine. I mean, we're 3D printing skulls, we're 3D printing bones and things like that. I mean, it's going to be big.
What's it going to be called, the Iowa City one?
The Steam Room Fab Lab. Look for them on Twitter, Facebook, and the web.
That's like super innovative.
Well, this is modeled after an MIT program. They have these across country. I'm excited about here because I've sort of been waiting for this sort of thing to come. Interesting. I was working with the director of this place, and he says that there hasn't been a lot of study on what determines the success of these sorts of places. But what they do know is that it's important to have access to food and coffee. That makes it successful.
Like, they sell it, or
in terms of membership and people like getting their work done. One of the things they also aim to do is to enable small manufacturing concern. Mm-hmm. So that will be it too.
So what's the target demographic? Small businesses that can't afford their own equipment, or someone like me who lives in an apartment and I want to build my own desk?
Both.
All of the above.
Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're currently working with the city for zoning issues. So that's kind of in the way. The city kind of has trouble wrapping their heads around this sort of industrialized process, opening a commercial area, I gather. But hopefully that will be taken care of. So I'm going to wrap this up before I go completely off the deep end with caffeine. So I want to thank you guys for joining me this week. You know, if only my theme music would play when I wanted to.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, I mean, like that? Is that too much to ask? What is happening? Boom, boom, all right. Boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom. Cole's doing a good job.
Yeah, we don't need this.
You should hire him instead of the machine.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see is a child.